Hey everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Everyone, and welcome to Pixels. In this show, we cover the gaming news from the gaming industry and hopefully try to give you the tools you need to understand it to the extent that we do understand it, which is not always the case. My name is Patrick Beja, and today I'm going to have a very quick show because scheduling was a little bit complicated. So it's going to be only me and just a few topics, which are going to be basically the streaming, which keeps coming. Streaming services keep being announced, and we have the Project X Cloud from Microsoft that was confirmed a few days ago. But I think it's going to be a good time to reflect on why things didn't work out in the past and maybe why they can in the future. We're going to have a little bit of Sony news as well, some Red Dead Redemption 2 controversy with Crunch taking up 100 hour weeks for workers at Rockstar, which has been making the headlines in the past couple of days, the release of Black Ops 4, which is surprisingly well received, and a few other little tidbits of news. We have a Harry Potter open world action RPG that leaked, and a few other things. So let's get started with Project X Cloud. So by now, I'm sure everyone has understood that streaming is the future. Basically, everyone agrees, everyone thinks so, and you should too. And if you don't, then you're not drinking the Kool-Aid, maybe. Maybe you think that streaming video games is not going to work out because it hasn't in the past. And as the world seems to be moving in that direction, I wanted to make a point which I think is getting lost in the enthusiasm or lack of enthusiasm for this new technology. Certainly, the video game industry is moving in that direction, and it has a lot of technical to a point, but also commercial advantages for many of the actors. So if it does work out, I think it's advantageous for most of the big actors in the gaming industry to embrace that technology. And if we look back, we've seen that technology implemented, or trials at implementing this technology, ever since On Live, which was launched, 2008 in the form it was. I'm checking now. I mean, it was founded in 2003. I think the product launched around 2007 or 8, something like that. And obviously, that didn't work out. They were not commercially viable, and they were bought by Sony, as was Gaikai, to basically create their PlayStation Now service, which itself is not the biggest gaming revolution we've seen. And they're having a few other projects which work or don't, depending on who you ask. Shadow PC is a French startup that has been enabling the streaming of a complete PC, and you basically have a remote computer in a data center and you can stream its video, but you do what you want with that computer. And for some people, it works very well. For others, it works, it's touch and go. And so that might lead some people to think, well, the technology is kind of like 3D TVs or maybe even VR. It's going to not work out as well as people will hope. And I think there's some truth to that. And most people think that way because of technical issues. A lot of people think technically the streaming technology is not adapted to video games. And a lot of people think about bandwidth. People think we don't have the bandwidth for this, which I don't think is the case. Bandwidth is mostly capable of playing pretty sustained video streaming. And obviously we have YouTube and Netflix and other video services, which work really well for most people. Of course, in those cases, you have the advantage of having the ability to buffer. So you buffer maybe 30 seconds or a minute of that video. And if the reliability, the bandwidth of your connection fluctuates, then you only get, the video doesn't stop because it can play up to a minute or maybe even more before you can feel that impact. And by the time your bandwidth has come back to where it needs to be, then it buffers more. So sure, in the case of video, you need to have a constant, reliable bandwidth width. And that is true. But I really think that in most cases, there are ways of, well, first of all, the infrastructure is getting to the point where video is not so much of an issue, period. And in some cases, I think there is a possibility of having, for example, I'm not an engineer, but let's imagine you have a baseline, let's say 480 quality that requires a lot less bandwidth, and the additional image encoding comes on top of that if you have the appropriate connection. Of course, it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to play the game if you only have bandwidth for the lower resolution, but it does mean that if your bandwidth fluctuates, then you don't get the game that stops entirely. You just default back to the lower resolution and you can still play for a little bit and it's annoying, but it comes back to the higher resolution as soon as your connection is capable of doing that again. So on that side of the technical things, I think there are ways to work around it to make it, of course, not as good as a computer or a console in your home, but workable. The real issue is latency, as we've spoken about many times, and latency is more difficult to fix. We've heard rumors from Project Scarlet, which is the next console and service from Microsoft, which is not just the Project xCloud, which, by the way, is essentially Xbox One's only. So it's probably a trial run, and maybe the infrastructure in the data centers can be reconfigured to provide higher quality services for their next consoles when the time comes. We'll see if that actually happens. But the point is, with the Project Scarlet, which is the next console for Microsoft, we've heard rumors of ways of alleviating the issues of latency. Because, of course, even if you do have the bandwidth, if you have a high latency, let's say 300 milliseconds to send a command to the data center and get it back and get the video back, then you're going to feel that in your gameplay experience. When you press up or press a button on your controller, then, you know, it takes a third of a second to manifest that command on screen. That's not a good user experience. People who have been trying the Google Stream, Project Stream service, are saying that they don't feel that. So I think in some cases, the infrastructure alone is enough to alleviate that issue. In some cases, you're going to need new technology, whatever it is that Microsoft is developing, some kind of predictive algorithm, machine learning, AI, throw in whatever buzzword you want to describe this, that will somehow magically fix it. Maybe that will happen. But latency is also something that is solved technically. My point is that this is not the main issue, the main reason why those previous services have not worked out. Some people already had the good infrastructure and technical capabilities to use those services, but even they didn't use them. And the problem was the commercial offering. Technically, it's one thing. Commercially, if you don't have the games that you want on those services, then obviously you're not going to subscribe. Whether they are Netflix type, all you can eat, subscription services, or even if you buy, let's say you pay $20 to play a game for a week or something like that. I don't know, how much it would be. Let's not get hung up on the amounts. But if there are no games you want, then it's not interesting. But if you have games that you do want, then all of a sudden this kind of technology becomes really interesting. And now that we're seeing, I mean, even with Sony's PlayStation Now, the offering isn't super compelling. Even if the technology works, which it doesn't perfectly, Sony doesn't have the networking or data center capabilities that Google or Microsoft has. I'm guessing they're beefing up that offering or that capability for their next console, which I'm sure is going to be just like the Xbox One or the Xbox Two, and is going to have a streaming service included. It seems pretty clear at this point. Then the games that you want to play are accessible just at the push of a key on your keyboard in your browser or, you know, on your console. It does become interesting. The PlayStation Now isn't perfect in that regard, but the next generation will certainly be pushed by the actors that have an interest in this. Microsoft, of course, is one. Google is seemingly bringing in a sizable competition in that department. And let's not forget, you know, all of the big publishers are going to see an interest in having that kind of technology enabled for them. Just in the way that it is interesting to them to access their players and their consumers directly through a store on your PC. And yes, it's annoying to have multiple stores, but it will be interesting to them to access their consumers through this service. Of course, it's going to be available on PC, but on any device, really, if you're thinking about it, any device that has a screen can become a way of playing those games, be it a phone, a tablet, a TV, streaming box, any of those. So what I'm trying to say is commercially, there's going to be a very strong push to be offering stuff for all of the actors. Because if Sony stays in that mode of, well, we're only going to have our back catalog on this service, Microsoft is not going to be doing that. It's very likely they're going to convert the Game Pass service, which has all of their first party and maybe others, to be translated into their streaming service. Similarly, Google is going to partner with a lot of people to offer games, and probably they're going to want to do the latest games. And the competition for the percentage amount that they're taking is going to be higher because you're going to have, again, many different services that offer this. And on top of that, you're going to have each individual publisher that is going to be offering this service. So they will want you to use that service because they don't have to pay anyone for when you're using that service. They can keep 100% of the amount. Does that mean we're going to have 15 different services? It is possible. I don't think there are going to be 15 different services with exclusives, though. I think if they play their cards right, Sony and Microsoft and possibly Google are still going to be the main players. You might throw Steam in there if they have been working on this for a while. And I suspect, you know, we don't know what Valve is doing with all of their piles of cash, and they're certainly not developing games, even though they're promising that they are. They're certainly not shipping games, let's say, until now. So maybe they're working on a similar service as well. The end result of all of this is that where we didn't have commercially interesting services before because no one wanted to license their games on live, now we are going to. And of course, you know, 10 years have passed and technically the technology is much more mature. So bottom line, I do think these services are going to represent a growing portion of the gaming market. And just like we were reluctant to having games just tied to a service specifically and buying them digitally in the beginning, initially there will be people who will think, well, we don't really want to have to use this. We'd rather have a console at home. And that is probably going to be the case for a long time, maybe forever, for core gamers like me and probably you. In the similar way, I think we're going to see some advantages to having the streaming service enabled as the infrastructure improves as well. 5G is designed for low latency, for example, so that might be an option as well. And fiber is very low latency, and it's being more and more accessible in more places. And the idea that you can just try a game out just by pressing a key, you don't need to download, install, you know, wait a few hours, is appealing. And the fact that you can play on any device, of course, not every game is going to be adapted to a tiny screen of a phone, but that is also going to be, as they say, bringing different kinds of games to different people. So all of this is kind of common knowledge. I think the main takeaway is that commercial aspect. The services will be interesting because they're of the higher competition and feasibility of this technology. So we'll see how it works out, but it seems incredibly unlikely that this is just a whiffing attempt at a how do you call it when you throw the baseball, like you bat it all the way out of a home run. There you go. That's the metaphor I was looking for. Maybe it's not going to be a super home run. Maybe it's going to be, but it's not going to be a strikeout. That's the other one. I don't think so. It's going to exist, and it's going to be interesting for different kinds of people. Talking about future consoles, Sony has confirmed that they are working on another PlayStation console. They declined to say it's going to be called PlayStation 5, although I would be very surprised if it wasn't. And I think it's going to be, as I said, just like Project Scarlet from Microsoft. I think it's going to be both streaming and home console at the same time. And we'll see exactly how it works out, but PlayStation Now has to be beefed up in order to be a viable player in the next generation, I think. We're probably going to hear more about them at this year's E3, by the way things are going. And, PSN name change is coming soon. So there are a bunch of details about how it's going to work. You're going to get one free name change, and then it's going to be $10 for non-PS Plus members and $5 for PS Plus members. Seems reasonable. You don't want people to change their names all the time. What I'm hoping for is that they will enable the ability for multiple people to have the same name. Everyone's doing that, you know, with the hashtag and then a series of four numbers after the name, four or more. And that is obviously enabling people to not have their name taken, and it's obviously something they should do. It's not clear yet if they are. If they're not, they're just moving the issue, just moving the goalpost, or the negative version of the goalpost. The hole that you're falling into is just a little bit farther, but you're still going to be falling into it because, well, you know the issue there. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the Red Dead Redemption 2 issue. And I mean, we've seen more gameplay trailers, and I've been pretty vocal about the fact that really we don't really quite see anything that would get anyone to not like the game, to not want to purchase the game. They've been in like neutral communication mode. They only sell you promises. They don't quite sell you on very exact features. So we don't know if they're going to be implemented the way they promise you, but they sell you a dream. And the reason for this, I think, from a communication standpoint, is that everyone is convinced they want the game. So the only, I can't remember if I talked about this last episode, I apologize if I did, but the only result they can achieve if they show you too much or very specific things is, well, there are two results. Either people still want to buy the game, so it's a net neutral result, or people decide, well, you know what, that's not really my thing, so in the end, I'm not going to get it when it comes, when the game is released. And that's a net positive, a net negative in the end. I don't think they can, at this point, there's so much hype for the game that I don't think they can convince more people to get the game that they weren't already convinced. So I think that's why we've seen this muted / aspirational communication. Even with the preview events, they've gotten people to play 4 or 5 hours of a very compelling experience. There is this, as we were talking about, this fantasy of a really living, breathing world. However, the cliche that image is, but we don't know what happens after 10, 15 hours. So obviously I'm going to be getting the game. I'm very excited for it. But yeah, I think that's why they've been communicating in that way. And the reason I'm bringing that up is that it was a perfect run for them up to the point that Dan Houser, who is one of the co-founders of the studio, went and did an article with, who was it? New Yorker, I think. And he said something about the team working 100-hour weeks several times in 2018 to finish the game. And it's really interesting because the results, the feedback, or the blowback, I should say, on that quote has been incredibly negative in a way that I don't think would have happened 10 years ago. The gaming industry, the gaming press, and the gaming public are, because of all of those stories that we've heard over the years, unbelievably resistant to the idea of crunch. Of course, it still happens. You know, you're finishing a game and your employees work maybe not 100-hour weeks, but 60-hour weeks, 70-hour weeks. And that was regarded as a good thing, kind of, like a necessary evil for a long time. At this point, it's not regarded as a necessary evil. It's regarded as an evil. And the blowback on Houser's quote was really interesting. Well, I think deserved, but also really interesting because it was the one faux pas for Red Dead Redemption 2's communication. I'm sure that he is incredibly well media trained and that he's not supposed to make mistakes like this. And when the article came out, a bunch of people in the PR department put their head in their hands and were thinking, okay, this is the thing. There's always a thing that happens before the project finishes, and that's the thing, and we have to deal with it now. So he put out a statement about this quote, saying that he was specifically discussing the writing team, which is the senior writing team of four people, and that, of course, they don't expect anyone in their company to work that much, and any additional work time that they put in is something that they do voluntarily because of passion and all of the things we usually hear. It was the New York Magazine that he gave an interview to. And I'm inclined to believe him. I'm inclined to believe that he was specifically talking about the writing team because that was the topic they were discussing in the interview, and that he didn't mean the entire company is putting in 100-hour weeks and that the employees are not supposed to, you know, are not forced to work that much. But, I mean, if you're putting in 100-hour weeks, first of all, the voluntary aspect of this is incredibly difficult to define. Peer pressure in a company is really strong, and if all of your coworkers are staying until 8 p.m. to work on that game, and you're the person leaving at 6, it doesn't look good. You are pressured to stay longer. And the I think it's fair to say that in any project, you do have moments when you have to work more and you have to put in those long hours and super difficult weeks. But I also think that in many cases, the people who do that reap more of the benefits of their work than video games employees, video games industry workers do. They, you know, most companies won't give you, you know, you don't have like stock options, or you're not going to get a portion of the profits of the game. Or if it's a portion, you know, you're going to get about $5,000 that year, which is great. But I mean, it's not proportional to the amount of money Rockstar is going to be making on that game, or that they made on Grand Theft Auto. Yes, it's proportional, but it's tiny. I guess the point I'm making is this is not something that should really be encouraged, even if it's voluntary, because it's just unhealthy and it's not sustainable. And all of these arguments we have heard for many, many months and sometimes years now. And I think we're coming to a moment of not quite reckoning, because I don't think it's sudden, but a coming of age of the industry where people are actually caring. The press is pointing those issues out as issues. The gaming public is aware that they are issues in a way that we weren't 10 or 15 years ago, even though we did have stories like, you know, the wives of EA and even the wives of Rockstar, which had its own moment. And those contributed to bringing these issues to the forefront. And that's important. And I think, obviously, I don't think anyone is going to boycott Red Dead Redemption 2. And there's a whole question about, should you penalize the workers for the issues that the company is putting on them? And all of this, I think, is not murky, but difficult to fall down on one or the other side of the issue. But I don't think anyone is going to boycott Red Dead Redemption 2, let's be honest. What is going to happen, though, is public pressure, and more, I think the media is informing the public, and the public is voicing their discontent at this. And the only result that can really happen is that the industry sort of regulates these kinds of things in a way that is reasonable. Again, I think it's okay to work really long hours when you're finishing up a project. People often say, you know, managers and lawyers and whatever put in really long hours and super long weeks when they have to finish up a trial or a project or whatever. And in this case, I don't think it should be prevented. But there is a culture of crunch in the gaming industry that goes beyond that. And that is an issue, especially when we have game as a service games, which are essentially constantly releasing stuff. So it's constant crunch, or it could be constant crunch. Unionization, I know, is a bad word for Americans, but I think it could be a way of regulating and reining in these practices. I think it could be a very effective way of doing that, if the public consciousness for this among developers and artists and people who work in the industry is starting to happen. And again, I think the reason that this is important is that it's unhealthy and not sustainable. People do burn out. People do realize, after having put, as we talked about with Telltale last time, after having put their life, poured their life into a gaming company and a game, that they are not the ones that are, you know, that the company really, and it's normal, the company doesn't really care about them. So it's not like it's going to take all of the precautions and the like loving embrace of their employees. And it's not supposed to. That's why we need the rules. So anyway, I'm not, you know, it might seem like a socialist rant to some people in the US, especially. I know there's some kind of allergic reaction to these kinds of things. But I hope that most people agree that there is an issue there. And if we can find a way of enabling, you know, voluntary overtime in some cases when it's needed, and of course the specifics are very difficult to pin down, how do you define when it's needed, how do you define more overtime, whatever, I'm guessing that most of these people aren't paid for every hour they work, so even if it is 70 hour weeks, maybe 3 weeks is okay and 6 months is not, and the acceptable thing is somewhere in the middle, maybe closer to the 3 weeks thing. Overall, the culture of crunch, I don't think, is a good one. It's dangerous for your health. It means people get, as I said, burnt out, and it's prevalent in this industry. So bottom line, again, going to the bottom line, I think the public is realizing all of this. The industry is realizing all of this. And I don't know if it needs to be self-regulation or unionization or government regulation. I have no idea. But I know that it's on the way. And I also think that it's going to take a lot of time. It's not going to be fixed. You know, it's not like, oh, the Red Dead Redemption 2 moment, when after that happened, then everyone was fine. It takes time. It takes time for people to make their mind about these things. It takes time for people to consider things like unionization. It takes time for companies to understand that it's unhealthy. And in the long run, you churn through employees and you don't get the best people. You don't keep the best people. So it's in everyone's interest to realize this, I truly believe. And I think the more and more companies are coming to that realization as well, and implementing those policies doesn't happen in a day. But I think over the next 5 to 10 years, of course there's still going to be crunch. It's always going to be necessary, but it has to be reined in, and it will be, I think, within a few years. So we'll see if my prediction comes true. So a few more bits of news. Of course, Call of Duty Blackout 4 just came out, and it's been really well reviewed. Of course, it's three very solid experiences, so it's very weird to have the classic multiplayer and the zombies mode and the Blackout. And it makes for a strange offering, because you can't really specialize in all three, it feels like. You choose your mode, and that's the mode you like, and that's the one you play mostly. But it's still, a compelling offering if you enjoy the three of them, and especially the Blackout mode, the Battle Royale mode, has been very positively reviewed. So I think most people looked at this and back at E3 and were thinking, all right, yes, sure, we'll see what happens. But they've managed to create an experience which is what most people seem to want out of PUBG, as we've said many times over the last few months, and make it polished enough that it's appealing. And there's also a gameplay type that people enjoy. It's more time to kill is much smaller, in the sense that you jump in, you find a weapon immediately, and you start playing really the game, which is shooting people. The really interesting question, which we did think about a few months ago, I think, is how do they perpetuate this mode? Do they just sell another Call of Duty next year? Or do they break out Blackout into another mode and make it, free to play or something? It's possible. I think it's their thing, though, selling you the new game every year, and it's worked out pretty well. Even though there have been declining sales, or at least physical sales, they've put out an interesting press release, Activision that is, which states that they have a new record for online sales and downloading, so digital sales. And that is a really interesting way of spinning the positive press release for that specific aspect of the sales that is positive, because the physical sales are down. But I can really believe that people are buying stuff digitally now. And that record, they mentioned it's like the best-selling PlayStation Store game on day one, or something to that effect. So I'm sure it's selling quite well. It remains to be seen if it's selling better than the previous one. It wouldn't surprise me that it doesn't. But I'm sure they're still making money. And of course, the game on PC is available through the Battle.net client, which means they don't have to pay the 30% to Valve to sell it on Steam, which means more money for them. Back to the point I was making, though. What do they do with their Battle Royale mode? Initially, I thought they would need to spin it out into a free-to-play game somehow. But I'm actually not sure anymore. I think their thing is selling you a box every year, and then they sell you additional maps and stuff throughout the year, and that's what they do, and it works for them, and they are being successful with this game, and people who want to check out the Blackout mode are going to think at some point in a couple of months, people who haven't already bought it, well, I also get the other mode, so what the hell, I'll just buy it with this 30% off deal that I'm seeing now. And it's, you know, a bunch of money that Activision puts in their pocket immediately without having to sell you additional stuff. And if they do sell you additional stuff, better for them. So it's still a good deal, and it's the way they've always done it. And the, you know, immortal and undying words of Tony Stark, that's how Grandpa Call of Duty did it. That's how Daddy Call of Duty did it. And it's worked out pretty well so far. So I think that's possibly how they're going to do it. But regardless, Blackout is a good mode. I might even, you know, I haven't bought a Call of Duty for a long time, and I'm hearing so many good things from, you know, professionals and people in my Slack channel, in the Rendezvous Tech and Rendezvous Jeux channels are really happy about it. So I think they managed to do something we didn't think they could. It's a success. And Activision, that's, you know, the, you can poo-poo the AAA machine and the industrial nature of a yearly release schedule, but, you know, it also means that you're going to get a polished, reliable baseline experience, and that's what we're seeing here. Okay, so Harry Potter open world action RPG, there's a leak that essentially showed a bunch of video from that game that we had no idea existed. Well, I guess we had some idea because there were some job offers that could lead you to think that maybe that's what, who is it that's doing it? Can't remember. It's Avalanche Software, not Avalanche Studios. But it seems like a cool take on the Harry Potter universe. You're playing as a wizard who comes in fourth year, and you experience Hogwarts and in a way that is separated from the canon of the books, meaning you don't meet Harry or Hermione or Ron or any of those, hopefully, but it still permeates the entire universe. And I would love to play a game like this. What I'm hoping is that it's not just, you know, using your wand as a gun. You know, I don't want to be throwing magic bolts to kill every enemy. I hope they find more interesting and fun ways of using the concept of magic in the world to create a fun experience. So probably it will be announced at E3 this year, we're guessing, if they're doing some consumer testing, which is where the footage leaked from. So yeah, I'm very curious about that, what that would be, if it can be something that is akin to, basically, if the relationship to the world of Harry Potter is akin to that of the Lord of the Rings in the Shadow of Mordor and Shadow of War games, I would be very interested, because that was the right way of approaching it, in that world, but not hammering you over the head with all of the characters that you know that make cameos every half second. Star Citizen is alive, and the Squadron 42, their single player game, there are a number of different projects in that gargantuan endeavor. They are at almost $200 million of funding, and we keep wondering where all that money goes. And apparently it's to pay actors. And they showed a trailer for Squadron 42, and they have, I would say, you know, there's Mark Hamill and Gillian Anderson and Michael Rhys Davis and Gary Oldman and Henry Cavill and Mark Strong. Like, there are real actors that have been working for that game, and I'm guessing that's where they're putting the money. The trailer itself, I think the reaction has been universally, maybe? That's the nature of people's reactions, I think. And it's really difficult. The actors are cool, but the game has to be a good game, and it seems a little bit generic. But, you know, I want a Wing Commander spiritual sequel, and I would love for it to be that. But we're still not sure exactly what it's going to be beyond lots of well-known faces motion captured. So, yeah. And Star Citizen, I'm not going to get back into the whole question of, is it a scam? Is it, you know, some people are happy paying for this and some people are paying a lot of money and the game is still not like it's in whatever alpha version, but Citizen Con is going well and people are happy about it, and when the game crashes they don't care, and when things don't work out they don't care. Some of it is impressive. The way the world is rendered is, you know, it's a very big project with an actual rendering of the world. Someone was talking about the fact that you get into a train and you move through the city, and it's not like you see inside the train and all of a sudden you're in another part of the city. You actually move through that city, which in which you can go at every portion of it. And so it's coming together a little bit, but we still don't have a date and we still don't have... I mean, at this point, it's really a case of, well, I'll be happy when I can pay $60 to get that game. And we'll see how it works out at that point. For now, I'm kind of tired of speculating. Borderlands 2 is coming to PlayStation VR. That's an interesting one. Solo only, but adapted hopefully to PlayStation VR. It seems like it has a lot of barf potential, but it has some interesting features like this... Bump mode, badass motherfucker mode, where time slows down and you can shoot stuff. And I don't know how Borderlands 2 is adapted to VR, but I'm curious to see what happens in that game, like how they actually make it work. Barf though, it's highly barfable. So, but if they're putting it out, it has to be managed. That aspect of it has to be managed, I'm guessing. No word on Borderlands 3, though, so that's a bummer. Microsoft is buying Obsidian Entertainment, and that is more proof that they finally woke up. They need studios, and we've already seen that they bought Ninja Theory, Playground Games, Compulsion Games. I mean, some of them were already kind of second-party games. But yeah, it's a good thing. We'll have to see how they are managed. But the blueprint really is that of Sony at the moment, which has a number of first-party studios that collaborate, that get the best out of the platform for their own individual game. And I hope that's what Microsoft does for, well, their next console. I don't think those studios are working on Xbox One games anymore. Maybe they are, maybe I'm wrong, but I think they've moved on. What else? Robert Kirkman is finding a deal with Telltale to finish The Walking Dead. So if you have paid for the final season of The Walking Dead, you're going to get your game, hopefully. And they're trying to work with the actual developers that were working at Telltale. So that's good. Not a perfect solution, but hopefully it cushions the blow a little bit. It would have been better if Telltale had actually managed to pay their employees for, well, if they hadn't gone under, first of all, but if they had managed to provide packages for when they were laid off. But, you know, what you going to do? The Witcher. Oh, Andrei Sapkowski is unhappy with CD Projekt Red and is asking for a lot of money. I won't get into the details of this. The thing is, he's been very vocal about games being crap and games, especially from The Witcher, not mattering. And that feels slimy to be coming to ask more money for whatever reason it is. And I understand there's a legal argument there. And it could be that he very openly admits that he asked for some upfront money because he thought the game was going to be crap and that it wasn't going to work out and that he didn't want to take the risk. At the same time, he is saying that it was just a deal for the one game and that they made many. And there's a part of the law in Poland that says if you made a deal and it turns out that one of the parties profited a lot more from that deal, then you can revisit it. So legally, he might be entitled to it. But as the author of Metro, Russian, I believe, has been saying, he's been very vocal about Sapkowski. He's been saying, you know, if the game didn't exist, your book would have stayed a tiny, obscure little book in Poland or in Eastern Europe. And now it's selling all over the world and it's being reprinted everywhere. So you're being a little bit, well, he's being less than polite about this story. So I understand both sides of it. I don't know. I mean, ultimately, CD Projekt is going to cut a check for him and he's going to go away. And that's going to be it, I think. That's about the conclusion of that. Ooh, there's going to be a live-action Monster Hunter movie and a live-action Mega Man movie. The team behind the Monster Hunter movie is the one behind the Resident Evil movies, which, as we all know, don't have anything to do with the games, but they're kind of fun in a ham way. They're really bad movies, but fun to watch, so maybe Monster Hunter will be the same. Maybe. I mean, I can understand how Monster Hunter can be turned into a movie. Mega Man? Yeah, I'm not so sure, but it's happening. Ooh, and Minecraft is not on the Apple TV anymore, and no one noticed. So I was thinking that maybe when the Apple TV came out and they had such an emphasis on games, I thought maybe there would be a spot for intermediary gamers, that they would enjoy games that aren't super hardcore and maybe not super casual like they are on the mobile, well, on mobiles. And it seems that, you know, at least for Minecraft, there were so few people playing it that it wasn't even worth it to maintain the app on the Apple TV when it's so close to the iOS version. So I'm guessing not many people play on Apple TV. And that promise of intermediary gamers is not becoming real. And I guess that's going to be it. Hey, talking about mobile, Stardew Valley is coming to mobile on iOS at the end of the month. So if you enjoy that, you can play that. And Thumper, pretty good game. It's coming on Android towards the end of the year, and I'm guessing on iOS after that. It's a rhythm game, and it's pretty fun. Some people absolutely adore it. I thought it was a decent thing, but I can absolutely see how it would be an enjoyable experience on mobile. So I think this is probably going to be a good adaptation of a big console or PC games to mobile. That seems like it would translate very well. And last topic I wanted to mention is the fact that the Destiny 2 expansions are going to be part of the Destiny 2 Forsaken expansion starting next week. Which is great news, because then it means you only need the Forsaken box in order to have the previous expansions. But it's been like a month and a half since the game came out. And they basically forced everyone who hadn't bought those expansions to buy them in order to play Forsaken for a month and a half. Meaning they kind of milked the people who were already customers, because, of course, as I've said many times, these expansions, these previous tiny expansions that came out last year, you wouldn't really play through them on your way to Forsaken. You could, but more likely you would just use your level up thing and go straight to Forsaken, especially because those expansions were crap and Forsaken is really good. And I'm not the kind of person who gets angry at corporations for the sake of it. I think usually what they do is, you know, it's fair game most of the time, not all of the time, but I think if you're willing to pay for it, then go ahead. And if you're not, then don't. And that is usually the choice that you have. But in this case, it really bothers me, because it means just for a month and a half, when people really wanted to play your thing, you milk them for another $25 or whatever it was, and then a month and a half afterwards you drop it? That is really slimy. I really enjoy Forsaken. It's not gonna deter from my enjoyment of Forsaken. It's a separate thing, I think, but it really irks me quite a bit. So, I mean, I didn't pay for them technically. I got the full thing for the price of Forsaken, so the expansions were free, but let's say it was Activision's fault. Yes, let's blame the big corporate overlord, Activision, for all the ills of the gaming industry. Let's do that. And that's going to be it for this episode. A little bit longer than I thought. This is basically the history of my life. And I thank you for listening. If you did, we will be back in a couple of weeks. And hopefully we can talk about, yeah, I think we will. We'll be talking about Red Dead Redemption 2, which I'm, of course, as the rest of the world, very excited to put my hands on. My name is Patrick Beja again. I am not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can find this show at frenchspin.com. If you want to comment on some of the things I did, please feel free to do so. And I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Talk to you then. Bye.